Welcome to the Fundamental Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Paul Saladino. This podcast is the result of my relentless search to understand and correct the roots of chronic disease and illness. In this podcast, I will share with you everything I have learned about how to live the most healthy and radical life possible. Thanks for joining me on this journey. What is up, you guys? What is up? Happy holidays to you all. However you are celebrating, I hope that you are with friends and family somewhere warm and cozy, or sunny and cozy, and enjoying this family time at the end of the year as we celebrate what was a pretty awesome 2019. I hope you all had a good one too. So as you guys all know, next year I've got my book coming out, The Carnivore Code. You can go to thecarnivorecodebook.com to pre-order, and it is going to be rad. It is done now, you guys, and I can't wait to share it all with you next year. You can also check out my website, which is carnivoremd.com, where you can sign up for my newsletter. And I have an exciting announcement. I now have a t-shirt, and you know what it says on the front? It says Stay Radical, and it says some cool stuff on the back, but I'm going to leave that as a surprise for you guys to go check it out. So if you are interested in the t-shirt, you can find a link to that on my website, which is carnivoremd.com. I'm going to post about it on my social media. You can find a link to the t-shirt through the link tree on my Instagram and other places. It's a fun t-shirt, you guys. If you want to support me and share the Stay Radical message, please do that. This week on the podcast, I have my good buddy, Dr. Will Cole, who is a very well-known gentleman for good reason in the functional medicine health space. He's a really great guy with some very forward-thinking ideas and is very able to articulate his views of inflammation and the roots of chronic disease in his books, which include Ketotarian, which is about plant-based ketogenic diets. We talk about that, pros and cons, during the podcast today. And his more recent book, which is called The Inflammation Spectrum. Most of what we talked about today were kind of the roots of inflammation. This was a fun conversation. He and I had some back and forth. Certainly, we had some differences in opinion on things, and it was great to be able to sort of share point and counterpoint about all of that respectfully, as is always, I think, good for the community and medicine and you all in general. So I think you guys will really enjoy this podcast with Dr. Will Cole. I had an amazing time at White Oak Cello, which I talked to you guys about last week. White Oak Pastures, these are my people, you guys. www.whiteoakpastures.com. And there's a special landing page for listeners of this podcast. That landing page is now info.whiteoakpastures.com/carnivoremd, but we're going to make it easier for you guys. And hopefully this week, maybe even when this podcast comes out, it will just be White Oak Carnivore MD will be the website. That'll be a landing page for me, for you guys, where you can find specials on things from White Oak Pastures. If you don't know about White Oak Pastures, really special group of people in Bluffton, Georgia, doing regenerative agriculture, rotational grazing, proper use of the land, and putting back into the land all of the compost from the entire farm, making the grass as green as anything I have seen on this amazing planet, meaning that the animals there are getting the cleanest grass, the best water, because it's all from an aquifer and wells on the property, and they are getting the most nutritious food from the very organic soil. I had a moment while I was there looking at dirt from the farm, which had 5% organic matter compared to a plot of land which does not belong to Will Harris, who owns White Oak Pastures, 25 feet over the fence line that was less than 1% organic matter. And this is what happens when we do regenerative agriculture. We put so much organic matter back into the soil that it's dark and brown and just full of life and nutrients that goes into the grass and then into all of the animals there and then into us. And also what goes into the soil is carbon, because they're carbon negative. So they give us nutrients, they give animals nutrients, and they put carbon into the soil. It's exactly the way it should be, exactly the way it's always been. And it's really what is best for the planet in a most fundamental way, because it feeds us, it feeds the animals, and it is what we should be supporting with our dollars. So check out whiteoakpastures.com. You can use the code CarnivoreMD for 10% off your first order, or Carnivore15 on any of the items that are on special every week, which you will find on the Fundamental Health landing page, info.whiteoakpastures.com/CarnivoreMD, soon to be White Oak Carnivore MD, I believe. And I think you guys will appreciate everything they are doing. And I hope you will all come to the next White Oakcella, which is going to be in May of 2020. I can't wait to tell you more about it soon, you guys. I'm also super excited to share with you always my people at Ancestral Supplements. This is ancestralsupplements.com. They are an amazing group of men and women in Texas who are creating grass-fed, grass-finished bone marrow organ supplements from New Zealand cows. And they are doing this in capsules so that it's much easier for all of us to eat these organs, which may be hard for us to travel with, hard for us to obtain in certain places, or maybe we just don't like organs, but we understand that eating nose to tail is super important, no matter we're carnivore, carnivore-ish, or keto, or we just are sort of full omnivore, but want to include organs in our diet, this will certainly improve our overall health quality. And if we are not able to eat the organs or don't want to or need the convenience or want to supplement with organs that we can't get, like brain or thymus or pancreas, this is the way to do it. These guys are definitely making the best stuff out there and doing it from the best place that I know of. They are very good people and only want for all of us to be healthier and more full of life on a daily basis. So check them out. They have a couple of new supplements you should see. They've got an eye supplement, which is coming out, which is really cool, as well as fat. So they made tallow in pills, which will help with fat absorption of the fat-soluble nutrients. So a lot of times we know that our ancestors have prized fat, and now you can get the fat, the tallow, in a pill through Ancestral Supplements, and they also have an eye one coming out, which is really something I'm excited about too. So check them out, www.ancestralsupplements.com. You can use the code SALADINOMD, I believe, at their Shopify site for 10% off your order. Let them know I sent you and let me know how you like their stuff. And they are putting back in what the modern world has left out. I am so excited to be promoting both Ancestral Supplements and White Oak Pastures. These are some of the best people I know, and they are helping us lead better lives, you guys. All right, on to the podcast. My friends, listen afterward for what is going on with me. I appreciate you all. Dr. Will Cole, welcome to the podcast, my friend. It's good to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited.
I know. We were just kind of doing the East Coast camaraderie before we jumped on the podcast. A lot of viewers may know that I grew up in Virginia as an East Coaster, and I'm now in the West, and you're holding it down in Pittsburgh, my man.
Yeah.
It sounded like you guys have a farm or some land. Like, tell me about this. Like, what is it like? Tell me about your life out there, because I think this will be a good segue to everything else we're going to talk about.
Yeah. So I was mentioning to you that my wife's from LA. So we lived out there. I went to school out there, and we were at this point, 11 or actually it's been 13 years at this point, but, where it was, okay, do we raise our kids? We had our baby boy was 2 years old at that point, and we were pregnant with our daughter, and we're like, do we want to live in LA? Or I was raised in Pittsburgh, the country, farm country outside of Pittsburgh. Do we want to go back there? And there was a lot of sort of signs pointing to the fact that we could have land and have a simpler life. And my wife was also a missionary in Uganda, in the jungles of Africa, Central Africa. So we settled somewhere between LA and the jungles of Africa, Western Pennsylvania. It's where we get the simple life, but we still have all the amazing aspects of the United States too. So we live not on a farm, but we live in farm country. We live in sort of a home on land, cow fields all around us, woods, like forests right in our backyard. So it's really enjoyable for me as a dad to see my kids being able to run around and do that. And it's really enjoyable for my wife, who grew up in LA, to see the childhood that she dreamed of as a kid, like adventure and exploring. And we get to have that here in Pennsylvania.
I think it's so important for all of us as children to have adventures. And though we can have adventures in urban spaces, I think that adventures in the natural world are pretty unique. I mean, I grew up in the suburbs, but in the suburbs of Virginia, there's still woods, and I got to play in creeks and fall in them and get a tick every once in a while and freak my parents out and, be in the woods and just kind of run around like a wild child. And that was a big part of growing up for me, even if it's a little microcosm of wilderness. And it sounds like your kids get to do the same.
Totally. Yeah. I'm the same way. I grew up in rural areas or suburban areas, depending on, you know, the age of my childhood. And it was a fun existence. You definitely can have it in urban areas too. But it's funny that kids in urban areas, I hear this from my wife and her siblings, they imagined, you know, running through the woods and living in cowboy times or prairie times. And I kind of had that weird prairie existence living in the 80s and 90s in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. That's awesome. That's awesome. And I think that if you were, maybe you've done this, but if you were to check the gut microbiota of your children, I bet they would be pretty diverse.
Yeah, I have actually my son, not my daughter, but they have a good bacterial diversity of the microbiome for sure, playing out in the dirt, and definitely their microbiome is thanking me, I'm sure.
I think that that's what we all need, is just to be in the dirt, to be in the wilderness, and probably to, you know, not take a whole lot of antibiotics, and we'll get this diverse microbiome. So
exactly.
So I did a little bit in the intro about you, but for people that may not know you, you've written two awesome books, Ketotarian, which we'll talk about a little bit, and then this newer one called The Inflammation Spectrum. And so tell us a little bit about Ketotarian, because I am similarly interested in ketogenic diets. I've recently done a couple of debates with Chris Masterjohn about the pros and cons of ketogenic diets. Why don't we just start with, like, what do you feel like the utility is for a ketogenic diet from your perspective as a functional medicine provider? Why would somebody want to do low carbohydrate? And, you know, like, why do we do this? Why do we do a ketogenic diet? What do you think is beneficial about this or not?
Yeah. So I'm, as a functional medicine practitioner, my day job is consulting patients. We primarily run a virtual clinic. Over 90% of our patients are online via webcam. So my heart and my passion is really immersing myself in these complicated cases. We deal a lot with autoimmune issues and digestive problems, neurological symptoms, just inflammatory problems at large. And the ketogenic diet, when done appropriately for the individual, can be a great tool to move the needle in a powerful way, where most of our patients that come into us to the clinic online, they're already very well read. They're doing way more than most Americans are as far as their health and wellness, because they've had to be their own health advocate in many ways. So we are used to kind of beyond the basic stuff, and tools like the ketogenic diet and fasting can be a powerful tools that I love. I get geeked out about the mechanisms and the science around its ability to act, the ketone beta hydroxybutyrate, to act as an epigenetic modulator, basically doing cool things for our biochemistry. And one of the main things that I'm excited about is its ability to lower inflammation levels. Because a lot of my patients, if not all of them, are struggling with various amounts of inflammation in different forms. So its ability to lower these RP3 inflammasomes and upregulate these pro-antioxidant pathways like AMPK and the NRF2 pathway. Really cool stuff for people that are struggling. The reason why I wrote Ketotarian is it was born out of my own personal health journey, wellness journey, and being a mostly plant-based eater for my childhood, like mid to late teens and mid to late 20s. And that sort of natural evolution to a ketotarian way of eating, which is a mostly plant-centric, a ketogenic diet. And I talk about grass-fed beef in there. I talk about the pescatarian approach in there. It's definitely not entirely vegan, but it is this sort of nutrient-dense, clean keto way of eating that I wanted to really bring, I think, a lot of the ketogenic community to this different way to do the ketogenic diet, and the plant-based community to bring them a different tool to use. Because most people are just living on carbs, and they're really just carbitarians, depending on various forms of sugar or things that turn into sugar, like carbohydrates, for fuel. So let's do this in a cleaner way to tap into the benefits of ketosis, to gain some metabolic flexibility, because these people are largely just depending on kindling on the fire or sugar for fuel their whole life. So that's where Ketotarian came out of, my own personal journey, clinical experience on the different benefits of ketosis.
Yeah, and I really appreciate that perspective, because I think that no matter what diet we do, whether it's mostly plant-based or paleo or carnivore, I think that, like, in all of these versions, vegan, carnivore, there are, like, dirty versions, and everybody's going to have their metric or their interpretation of what dirty keto is or dirty carnivore is. And, but I think that the conversations around how do we
refine these and how do we make these diets cleaner or more optimal are quite useful. My perspective on dirty keto is when people end up using a lot of nut flours and a lot of sugar alcohols and a lot of kind of processed keto foods. Mm-hmm. And I like that in Ketotarian, it's kind of like a whole foods, mostly plant-based ketogenic diet, which is certainly going to be an improvement from that. Is that kind of how you feel like it's an improvement? Like what is, or what do you think about dirty keto and how does that kind of move the needle in a positive way?
Yeah, I think that's definitely an aspect of what makes something a dirty keto. And the other aspect of it is I think people going for anything as long as it's high fat, low carb. Like if they're having any old dairy or any old meat, because it's fitting the macronutrient construct of high fat, low carb, of course it's better than the standard American diet. There's no doubt about it. You're right. Off of the carbage and the junk food, but just because something's better doesn't necessarily mean it's optimal for long-term health. And I want someone to lean into optimal, whatever that looks like for them. And it's going to be various, you know, various forms for different people. And that's the part of functional medicine. It's bioindividuality. So people that have, that are eating lots of meat and dairy, especially conventional, I think that there's going to be long-term problems for some people. Some people can get away with it and it's going to be more good than bad. And I'm definitely not into fear-mongering or broad sweeping statements, but I have seen, and I do see people that are doing the conventional ketogenic diet, one that maybe somebody wouldn't even call dirty keto, but still have problems with it. So I wanted to bring in some other tools in Ketotarian for people to mix it up a bit to kind of see if they can continue to move past that plateau maybe that they're stuck at after that initial honeymoon period with the ketogenic diet, and which I hear of a lot and I see a lot. These are some other tools in Ketotarian for you to experiment with.
What are those pitfalls? What are those situations you've seen with people doing more traditional ketogenic diets where they run into trouble?
One of them is dairy and people having dairy sensitivities, casein reactivities, and the people love dairy. I don't know if you knew this or not, but dairy is a thing. It's like people love their dairy. And then
I know.
And then you give them a ketogenic diet and they're like, what the heck? I thought I couldn't eat dairy. Now I get to eat dairy. It's part of my plan. And it works for some people, but then other people, they have problems with it. And after that honeymoon period of the ketogenic diet ends, then they're having digestive problems. They can't lose the weight. They're not getting all the benefits that they're reading about with the ketogenic diet. So we talk about beta-A1, beta-A2 casein in Ketotarian. We talk about ghee, clarified butter, which is a Ketotarian food. It's a vegetarian keto food for people to lean into because it's predominantly casein free. But then some people even have problems with even the ghee. So we need to talk about going completely dairy free. And most of the recipes are in Ketotarian. So that's one. And then the other component would be lots of saturated fat, and you can't blame just red meat on that because coconut oil would be under that as well as ghee and dairy. People with the ApoE gene alleles and people with significant intestinal permeability where these saturated fats can raise inflammation because those lipopolysaccharides and those gram-negative bacteria in higher amounts, they, and there's studies that reflect this, but I just see it in seeing patients, is that you'll see higher inflammation levels and you'll see the NMR panel move from A, pattern A on the subfractionation of lipids to pattern B on a ketogenic diet, which shouldn't be. When you look at the studies and the benefits of that, well, what's going on? For some of these people, it's either a gene allele with the way their body metabolizes saturated fats and shuttles it to different parts of the body, or it is some intestinal permeability where the dysbiosis is impacting inflammation levels, or both. So those are some tweaks that people need to consider. And that doesn't mean, abandon the ketogenic diet because it's not working for you. Well, maybe it's not working for you in the way that you're doing it. Maybe you need to adjust it to still tap into the benefits of metabolic flexibility and not abandon it entirely. So those are some things that I talk about in Ketotarian that I see consulting patients.
That's awesome. I love it. So I've talked about dairy a lot in my work too. People always ask me this on a carnivore diet. They say, what about dairy? And my response is, hey, look, I've tried 3 times personally to incorporate dairy back into my life, and every single time I get immunologic reactions. I had eczema that was really bad, and I've tried multiple times to do organic, raw A2 dairy from exclusively goats. Like, I am like walking out to the field, not literally, but basically metaphorically, I am milking the goat myself. I am getting the best milk that I can imagine, A2 or, you know, like raw goat's milk, and I still get reactivity. So I do think that the A1 versus A2 isoform of casein is a good thing for people to know about. And we can just break that down briefly in case people don't know. But, you know, there are milk proteins, casein and whey are the major ones, and there are two variants, A1 and A2 of casein. And the A1 variant of casein is in most cows in the United States. There's a few Guernsey and Jersey cows that might be labeled as A2, but most cows in the United States are A1 milk. And it breaks down into beta-casomorphine 7, as you said. And there's multiple studies that kind of suggest, I think most of them are epidemiology, as we have to rely on in this case, but there are associations between increased consumption of BCM7, beta-casomorphine 7, and increased autoimmune disease. So that's kind of concerning, you know, is A1 milk causing type 1 diabetes or some of these other things? Potentially, we need to be aware of it. Mm-hmm. And so, so I thought, well, maybe I can do A2, right? And that didn't even work for me. And what I've noticed with milk, as you suggest, is that dairy is delicious, and people like dairy. And so people want to eat cheese, they want to drink milk, and they want milk in their coffee. And I kind of caution them gently and say, hey, look, I just don't think that dairy is great for most people. And if you're stumbling, you're not getting weight loss, you're getting reactions, your eczema or psoriasis isn't going away on a carnivore diet, that's probably worth cutting out all dairy, even A2 dairy. But I mean, I just did an experiment a few weeks ago with raw goat's milk, and I was like, I just didn't want to believe it for the first days. I was like, man, my beard is itchy. My neck is itchy. I just kept going. And I was like, ah, it's the milk. I hate it. So now I have $50 of raw goat's milk in my fridge if anybody in San Diego wants to come get it. But, you know, the dairy, the satiety thing is interesting too, because these casein peptides can activate the opiate pathways. And I talk about this in my book as well. And I think they affect satiety negatively because of that. If anyone listening to this podcast has ever eaten cheese or had whole milk, they know that it's you can drink a lot of it. It doesn't really have a very satiating effect. So it can get in the way of a lot of weight gain and weight loss. And then what you also said there about APOE4, I want to touch on that too, because I'll offer maybe some counterpoints there that are interesting for people. The saturated fat thing is quite interesting as well. I totally agree with you about saturated fat and dysbiosis. I talked with Tommy Wood about this on a previous podcast. My impression is that most of the problem with saturated fat is in people who have underlying dysbiosis. I think there's pretty good evidence that for whatever reason, these saturated fats, these molecules of fat without double bonds, without unsaturations between the carbons, do create lipid rafts in a more avid way in the gut and can shuttle endotoxin, which is lipopolysaccharide from gram-negative organisms. And my sense is that it's probably related to underlying gut dysbiosis in the first place. And if you add saturated fat to a disordered gut, then it's kind of like fuel to a spark and it gets to be a problem. And I think in those people, as I talked about with Tommy on the podcast probably a few months ago, a low fat approach is probably good. And something, you know, even if it's like a plant-based low-fat approach, I guess if you're doing low-fat, you're going to have to use some plants for carbohydrates. That's probably a good thing until you can get the gut figured out. I haven't seen any convincing evidence that saturated fat in and of itself is dangerous for humans. And this is one of the things that I like to try and just dig into with people and really clarify, because so many people hear saturated fat is bad, saturated fat is bad, but really saturated fat is just a molecule that's in our bodies. We need it. We make it. And it has to be in every membrane in our body. But I think that for some people, if they have underlying gut inflammation, that it can be a bad addition, and that could be an issue. A lot of the studies done with saturated fat and endotoxinemia or postprandial endotoxinemia have to do with dairy. And so I wonder about certain types of saturated fat being more capable or having an increased proclivity to form these lipid rafts and getting stuff across. The APOE4 thing is really fascinating. And this is one of the ones that I think is we might differ a little bit in our opinion. So I'm not convinced that people who have APOE4 polymorphisms need to avoid saturated fat. As far as when I dug into the research, everything I could see was just kind of epidemiology and associations and some really interesting studies. I did a whole podcast on APOE4 with Tommy as well. And we talked about the Bolivian Simone, and then there's some Yoruba in Peru, I believe, some indigenous people that have like almost exclusively APOE4. Polymorphism of this apolipoprotein, and it appears to be protective for them in terms of cognitive decline and even for inflammation. And the other thing that's fascinating to me about APOE4 is that's our genetic history. APOE3 didn't show up until like 200,000 years ago. So for the majority of human evolution, we all had APOE4. And we may get into, you know, the anthropologists may differ. I certainly believe that humans have been eating animal meat with saturated fat for throughout our entire evolution. And I make sort of the case in the book that it was the eating of meat that caused our brains to grow rapidly 2 million years ago. And so I think there's at least a pretty reasonable case to be made that humans have been eating meat with an APOE4 allele for the majority of our evolution because APOE3 didn't show up until really recently. Mm-hmm. But what I saw when I kind of dug into this and was writing this section on the book was that APOE4 is this molecule. It's this apolipoprotein that transfers cholesterol from the astrocyte to the neurons in the brain primarily. The brain can't really make its own cholesterol, so it has to make it in the astrocyte, and the astrocyte has to get it to the glial cells or the neurons. And what it appears is that in people with insulin resistance, they're uniquely susceptible to kind of a breakdown of their APOE4 movement of that cholesterol into the neurons. And so my hypothesis is that it's not APOE4 that's bad. It's that APOE4 in the setting of insulin resistance is really bad, and that we haven't really been insulin resistant throughout our evolution. And when people get insulin resistant with APOE4, things really go off the rails, and that's when things get to be a problem. So the question, or sort of the alternative hypothesis, is it okay for someone who's insulin sensitive with APOE4 to eat a saturated fat-rich diet? And there's just one really interesting kind of case study that I'll share. I can send this to you. I don't know if you've seen this one. So the title of this one is APOE4, The Door to Insulin-Resistant Dyslipidemia and Brain Fog, a case study. I think it's from 2012 it's 2019. No, 2012, Alzheimer's and Dementia Journal. But what's so cool is this is just one patient, admittedly, and it's a heterozygote for APOE4. So it's an APOE4 carrier who has diabetes. So it's somebody with APOE4 who's insulin resistant, and they put them on a ketogenic diet, which presumably has lots of saturated fat. I mean, perhaps they're doing a low saturated fat ketogenic diet. And I actually emailed the authors to get a sense of how much saturated fat they had on this diet, but I suspect they had saturated fat on this diet. And what they found was, when they put this person with APOE4, they actually had baseline cognitive impairment. Their MoCA was 23 out of 30. MoCA is the Montreal Cognitive Assessment. It's what we use clinically to get a sense of how well someone's thinking. This is sort of famous. People may know politically that like Donald Trump boasted about having a perfect MoCA. Anyway, but when they put this person on a ketogenic diet, a high-fat ketogenic diet, presumably high in saturated fat, their MoCA improved from 23 to 29. The A1C went down from, I believe, 7.8 to 5.5. Inflammatory markers resolved or improved, and other biomarkers of metabolic syndrome improved. I just thought it was so interesting that even in somebody with APOE4, they're a heterozygote, but they had insulin resistance, they put them on a ketogenic diet, and all the markers got better and their cognitive function improved. It's kind of like, oh, this is cool. We need to study this more. So what do you think about that?
No, I mean, I was, as you were talking, I was thinking of different cases where I have seen APOE4/4 or 3/4 where people are having higher saturated fats. And again, we know, hopefully people know this, that red meat is not just saturated fat. It's right. You don't want to oversimplify that. I think coconut oil can be more problematic for these people, more than red meat. But you can run their markers. You look at their inflammation markers. You look at their NMR panel, and they look brilliant, even though they're having high saturated fat. So I don't want to be overly reductionist and say, well, it's just that. I think it is a confluence of genetics and epigenetics, a sort of perfect storm of factors, with insulin resistance definitely being at the top of the list of being the sort of combination where the gut's probably another driver of that too. So it's really hard for me as a clinician to see, well, is it just that? And it normally is a perfect storm and not just the magic bullet where it's that one gene. And I almost can in many ways compare that APOE gene allele to things like MTHFR. You can have a homozygous MTHFR, the C677T location one, and they don't have a homocysteine. They don't have any things that MTHFR is associated with. So we are more than our genetics, and it's definitely not enough to say, well, you have that gene allele, that's for sure going to happen, and you're predestined to have this problem. But I do think it's a confluence of factors, with the APOE being one combination with the insulin resistance, the gut issues, that could be a problem. So we're on the same page. I think you cannot, I can't, because I look at these gene alleles on every patient and you do not see the same thing for every person that's coming in with this specific gene SNP or gene allele.
And I think that unfortunately within the popular media, these statements get made and they're black and white. You know, it's like, I don't know where this idea got promulgated, but people will say like, I can't eat red meat because I had ApoE4. And I think your ancestors have been doing it for 6 million years. You know, there was no such thing as ApoE3 or ApoE2 until 200,000 years ago. So I want people to know that, like you're saying, it's all about context. That's how I think about lipids. That's how I think about ApoE4. That's how I think about FTO, which is another one that we can talk about. I think that what's so fascinating to me is that probably one of my favorite studies from the book that I'm writing is one that shows that 87.8% of people in the U.S. have metabolic dysfunction. And you think, wow, if we're all swimming in dirty water, no wonder all the studies look, and everyone has insulin resistance, no wonder the studies look bad. But for those of us that don't have insulin resistance, a lot of this stuff may not play out in the same way. And I want people to know that they can choose foods from a variety of sources that may be more nutrient dense. The fear mongering around red meat is like, whoa, whoa, whoa. The same thing with FTO. And we don't have to go into that now, but people often email me and say, I have an FTO polymorphism. Can I eat saturated fat? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So yeah. The other thing, and then the newer book you have, and we're kind of hinting at this too, and I love that there's a segue between ketosis and inflammation, is the inflammation spectrum. And so I heard you talking about this on a couple of podcasts and I was like, wow, this is so true. Like, we think so similarly about this. So tell me about your conceptualization of the inflammation spectrum, and let's talk to people about how inflammation is multifaceted and sort of is demonstrable in so many different aspects of our bodily existence.
Yeah. So it's something that was also born out of my clinical experience of seeing patients, and how we know, obviously, as clinicians, that inflammation is this commonality between just about every health problem we face as a world today. And it's easy for people, like the layperson, to think, okay, they know inflammation is not good. They think of it as maybe musculoskeletal issues, maybe migraines, aches and pains, but it is it's more far reaching than just that. And it is a sort of nebulous term, but it is a product of the immune system, inflammation. It is inherently important when it's balanced. I mean, you mentioned saturated fat and the healthy balanced inflammation that things like that, and our immune system needs that for optimal fighting viruses and bacteria and optimal immune function and cellular function. It's very important, inflammation, when it's in check. But chronic inflammation is when it's thrown out of balance. And chronic inflammation is that what's associated with all these different health problems, from autoimmune conditions, which is a lot of my patient base, people with digestive problems, metabolic issues like we've been talking about, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, all chronic inflammatory, to something that I've been talking a lot about in talking about this book, is this cytokine model of cognitive function, and basically looking at cytokines, pro-inflammatory cells, and how they're impacting mental health and how our brain works, and the connection between anxiety and depression and fatigue and these neuroinflammatory components there, as well as neuroinflammatory autoimmune problems too, which like things like MS. So it is near and dear to my heart. These are the people that I spend my life with consulting and trying to get them better. And it exists on a spectrum, from mild symptoms, low grade fatigue, maybe background anxiety, digestive symptoms like bloating on one end of the inflammation spectrum, all the way to the other end, which is the ICD-10, like diagnosable autoimmune condition or metabolic issue or mental health problem, and then everything in between. So the goal, hopefully it reaches its goal. But why I wrote the inflammation spectrum was just to raise people's awareness to the fact that, okay, we're going through, if you look at these statistics, like you said, most of the human race are going through these problems. Most of the people that are listening to this right now, if they're not going through it, they know someone, they love somebody that is going through these inflammatory health problems. So it is, it's important for people to know, because you have to know what you're up against to do something about it, and what your work is and what my work is. It's just, we wield so much agency over our wellness in so many ways. So let's start doing things that brings down that inflammation, modulates it, calms it, so we can start allowing our body to repair itself and to recover and to live the life we're created to live.
I couldn't agree more, man. That's so well said. I really think that this is the model that needs to be taught in medical schools, and maybe you and I will be teaching in medical schools eventually. And because, you know, I did my residency in psychiatry, so the cognitive stuff is super near and dear to my heart. I practice much more broadly. these days, but you know, there was never a mention of the cytokine model of depression or the cytokine model of anxiety, schizophrenia, or bipolar. And I went to the University of Washington, which is no slouch in terms of, you know, psychiatry residencies. And there was never anybody talking about this. And so I discovered it. Oh, I didn't discover it, but I was like doing research and I was like, wow, this is really cool. Neuroinflammation. Look at all these cytokines. Look at this IL-6 elevated in the CSF of suicide attempters. Look at this study that really shows that other inflammatory markers, TNF-alpha, are elevated in people with depression, and it correlates with the severity of the illness. And none of the people that I worked with there were aware of this or talked about it. But I think that you're so on point here, and I agree with you completely, that inflammation is at the root of almost everything. You know, we have to be careful of hyperbole in medicine, but in order to just really distill it for people, I've said this before, like, inflammation is the root of the problem. And, you know, maybe we can talk to people about what inflammation is. We touched on it briefly, but in medical school, I never had a course where they were like, this is inflammation, right? Nobody ever said that. And I did a lecture when I was in residency. I stood in front of a room of 30 doctors and 30 medical students and a bunch of other people. And I said, what is inflammation? And really nobody could answer me. And a few people offered some things and they were like, oh, it's like an angry mob on the street. And I thought, yeah, that's a good start. That was one of the attending physicians. But the medical students didn't have that answer on the tip of their tongue as to what inflammation was. And I think that's one of the reasons that Western medicine is not doing as well as we'd like it to for patients. And I love how with this model, you sort of show how it can transcend organ systems and it moves throughout the body. And we can have inflammation, which can be anxiety, depression, irritability, GI distress, acne, you know, rheumatoid arthritis, gut problems, rashes. I think this is where Western medicine needs to go in terms of the way we think about this. And I like the term inflammologist. I think that we are all inflammologists. I think you and I should start a board certification in inflammology. What do you think?
I'm up for it. Let's do it.
We'll be the first two board certified inflammologists in the country. I think we'd have a few.
It'll catch on.
Yeah. And so when we're thinking about it that way, so what's cool is in the book, I like that you do this and I've heard you say that you kind of draw from your experience as a functional medicine clinician. When we see patients, we're going to ask them about all these symptoms. And in the book, you have this kind of quiz where you go through and you help people. I like that the quiz broadens the perspective of inflammation and helps us really get a sense that this can be manifest in all these symptoms in our body. So what are the main symptoms of inflammation that you see in people, or how does it manifest? You kind of touched on it a little bit, and then maybe give us a definition of inflammation.
Yeah, sure. So the way I define inflammation, it's a product of our immune system. So it is, again, not inherently bad. It's just subject to the Goldilocks principle, just like so much of, you know, everything else in our body, our gut microbiome, bacteria, yeast. It's not inherently bad. We don't want overgrowth of yeast and bacteria. Our hormones, we don't want excess of hormones. We don't want a deficiency of hormones. And same with inflammation. We just want it in check and to work when we need it to work, but calm down when we need it to calm down. The problem is many people, their inflammation's too high for too long, burning low grade in perpetuity. And that is what's associated with all these health issues that we're talking about. And when you talk about cellular inflammation, the impact that has on cell membrane and the mitochondria and the systemic cascade that can cause throughout the body is what research is really looking at a lot of these chronic inflammatory health problems. So the quiz that you're referencing in the inflammation spectrum is adapted from questions that I ask patients. It's adapted from functional medicine perspectives on health. So it is just, I made it a little bit more user-friendly for the reader to kind of go through it. So there's the way that I saw it in the book and the way that I envisioned it was seven main sections on the inflammation spectrum. So we talk about brain, we talk about the gut and the connection of the two. We talk about the brain hormonal axis, the endocrine system. We talk about blood sugar regulatory system, detoxification. We talk about autoimmunity as separate. And that was an intentional decision that I made when writing the book because I wanted to differentiate inflammation from autoimmunity. You can have inflammation but not have autoimmunity, but every autoimmunity is inflammatory.
Exactly.
So, and then the eighth section, which is kind of what we just touched upon, the interconnectedness of the body is inflammation in one area can beget inflammation in other areas, or polyinflammation as I referred to it in the book. So it kind of shows people in their own way, and it's not a lab, but it's just subclinical a questionnaire quiz sort of way for people to find pointers in their life. Because a lot of those questions, like you said, it's far reaching. So people can will take the quiz and be like, whoa, I thought that was normal. Like, I thought that was just me. No, it's not just you. This is a sign of inflammation and you need to not settle for it. And we can go through all of these things that people just think it's just their everyday. So they equate that with normalcy and something that I sound like a broken record, but just because something's common doesn't necessarily mean it's normal. Ubiquity doesn't necessarily equate with normalcy. Many people just settle for a lousy existence because they think that's that just them. And they just think it's them getting older, or they're just stressed out. And the reality is, and what we see is that many people are settling for these things they don't need to settle for, and they really can optimize their health and overcome them. So that's how I wanted to start the book out, to kind of lay the framework for people to kind of, again, know what they're up against and know what they're dealing with so they can then take action.
That's so awesome, dude. I love that you put it that way. I think so often people will go to their doctors and the doctor might even say, I'm getting old. Or people, yeah. as westernized humans, we buy into this narrative. I'm getting old. My joint hurts because I'm getting old. Your joint might hurt because you have inflammation in the joint and you have some autoimmune stuff going on. Or you might have a skin rash because you have inflammation. And I really appreciate this message not to settle. I don't think we should settle for things. I think that no matter what age we are, we have the birthright to be vital, and we shouldn't be suffering with insomnia, constipation, diarrhea, or any of these things, anxiety, depression. Like I rebel against this subtle propaganda within medicine across specialties that illness is genetic and inescapable.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that is where the pharmaceuticals kind of swoop in. They say, oh, we've got this wonderful drug. You know, you've got this disease. You got dealt a bad genetic poker hand. We've got this wonderful pharmaceutical to treat your symptoms. I think that if Western medicine woke up to the fact that these are all correctable things, there would be a much greater impetus to actually figure out the root cause and to correct it. And that's what we're both about. So that's awesome. Yeah.
And it's so easy to say, right? I mean, it's just getting older, or that you're just a new mom, or you just need to lose weight. It's so easy to say that because there's no lab that you can gauge that's for a reason. And they're just running these basic tests to give the appropriate medication. So it's a very simple answer. But the reality is you can find, most of the time when people say that, I mean, they come and they tell me that's what they were told. We can find measurable things on labs that are contributing and causing why they feel the way that they do. So it's definitely not just my opinion where, you know, I think differently than their conventional doctor. It's like, no, they're not running the labs to even look at what's going on here. These are things you can improve and support and overcome and heal and reverse. So if we can do that, why would we settle for anything less? You know, that's where I'm coming from.
No, I love it. So I did a whole podcast on blood work. If people are interested in that, they can refer back to that. But let's talk a little bit about the blood work that you run, because you talk about this in the book, and I love empowering listeners of this podcast to know what blood work to ask for and look for. And it was cool to see what kind of blood work you were running. So let's dig into that a little bit.
Sure. So in the inflammation spectrum, I mentioned mainly the inflammation markers for people to see. And those would be high sensitivity C-reactive protein, HSCRP. In functional medicine, we want it under 1. The American Heart Association, the CDC, typically on like Quest and LabCorp, you'll see these low, average, and high relative risks for heart attack and stroke. And that's typically why they're running HSCRP. And it's interesting that even if someone gets HSCRP ran in the conventional setting, but even if it's high, they're not really going to do anything for you. They're just going to say it's high and this inflammation is high. But we want to actually get that to the optimal range there. Homocysteine is another one. Going back to HSCRP, you mentioned interleukin-6 with people with suicide. It's also HSCRP can be a surrogate for interleukin-6 too. Homocysteine in functional medicine, we want homocysteine to be under 7. Above 7, studies have shown it acts as a neurotoxin and can drive neuroinflammation. It's associated with increased blood-brain barrier permeability. What they commonly, the lay term is this is leaky brain syndrome, or increased blood-brain barrier permeability, which is associated with this neuroinflammation that researchers are looking at. Dr. Brendazin is a wonderful researcher looking at Alzheimer's and dementia and neurodegeneration, and it's his connection with homocysteine is pretty exciting too. And those are two basic tests that people can run. They don't need a functional medicine doctor necessarily to run those, even though we do run them for people. You can get these with your local PCP or GP. You can get them with a lot of direct-to-consumer labs as well. Ferritin is another biomarker that's also a basic conventional test you can get. Depending on if you're a man or a woman, if you're cycling and menstruating or not, there's going to be different optimal ranges for that, and they're in the book. But basically, we don't want to see super high ferritin levels, which is a biomarker for stored iron. So you have to look and put it in context with the iron and the total iron binding capacity and the iron saturation. But it also can act as an acute phase reactant. So basically, in states of inflammation, you can see ferritin spike. Those are some basic tests. And then in functional medicine, we get a little bit more deeper as far as our perspective on inflammation. So we're looking at gut-centric inflammation, which we've talked about, the lipopolysaccharides and the endotoxemia, looking at dysbiosis, looking at intestinal permeability or leaky gut syndrome, which is associated with all of these chronic inflammatory health problems, and gut-centric sort of gut immune markers like calprotectin and lactoferrin and lysozyme. We see those high in a lot of people that aren't even going through overt like IBD issues like Crohn's or ulcerative colitis or IBS. They feel like their GI system is normal, but then you run these labs and you see these high gut-centric inflammatory markers, meaning that what's going on in their gut is causing that systemic inflammation or at least contributing to it. And then we look at those genetic SNPs that I mentioned, like the APOE, APOE2. We'd look at the MTHFR, other methylation gene SNPs, and the endocannabinoid system, which regulates inflammation too, specifically in the gut. So those are some things that we look at.
I like that. And so if we go through these, yeah, hsCRP, I've talked about that a lot in the past. People are probably familiar with that one. You want to see that one as low as possible. Usually, when I look at my clients, they're less than 0.3. If it's above one, I definitely raise an eyebrow and I think there's something going on there. But a lot of the time, once we get stuff figured out, it'll go down to 0.3, and this is hsCRP. And then the other one that I've been doing recently is F2 isoprostane to creatinine ratio, which I like, probably more of an oxidative stress marker. I might add 8-hydroxy-2-deoxyguanosine or lipid peroxides for oxidative stress. I like to kind of divide it into oxidative stress markers like those, and then inflammatory markers, quote unquote. Obviously, there's no real delineation there, but some of them are immunologic and some of them are oxidative. And then I like what you were saying about ferritin. It's interesting. I actually donated blood yesterday because my ferritin was kind of creeping up. It was probably around 270. And so when people are interpreting ferritin, as you're suggesting, we need to think about it in context. If the hsCRP is normal, is like 0.3, and your ferritin is high, you may have excess iron, and that can be oxidative stress as well. And then I usually see that in the F2 isoprostane. So I'll see someone, I had a client the other day with a ferritin in the 400s. He doesn't have hemochromatosis, but he has the H63D polymorphism. And on a carnivore diet, we're getting lots of iron. So I was like, hey man, you better go donate blood. I don't see it as a contraindication. I just think we need to look at it carefully.
Yeah.
And the ferritin can be misleading. If someone does have inflammation, you can't say anything about their iron store with the ferritin. You have to look at the other metrics. Yeah. Serum iron, TIBC, et cetera, et cetera. But the ferritin, I think, is something for people to keep an eye on if they're eating a lot of red meat. It's not a contraindication to it. It just means some of us are from a genetic stock of people who absorb iron more avidly.
Yeah.
What do you think of for ferritin as your cutoff if somebody doesn't have inflammation?
The upper limit is typically around 250. So anything above 250, we have to ask questions. So like you said, I'm not alarmist where you're like, stop all red meat. And you know, you have inflammation. You want to put it in context, look at the labs around it. We put all the blood tests on a spreadsheet as, you know, and keep it super geeky and making sure we can understand where this is coming from, and then retest, after a little time. You don't want to make huge decisions all the time on one snapshot in time on a Monday morning at 7 a.m. when you went and got the lab, but start seeing if it's a trend. Was it just a random thing? Are we seeing consistently this is a problem? And then we can make action steps accordingly.
I've also used fasting insulin as kind of an inflammatory marker. If that bumps, you know, if somebody's eating a low carbohydrate diet and their fasting insulin is above 5 or 6, I'm like, that's not right. You know, something else going on here. Obviously it's contextual. And if somebody's eating a lot of carbohydrates, that could just be insulin resistance with a high fasting insulin. But I think those are some good ones. But it's such a geeky, fun rabbit hole to think like, how do I know if I have inflammation, right?
Yeah.
Because people probably know what their symptoms, but when they come to see you or me, it's interesting to have a metric to show them on paper and be like, this is what we're tracking. Let's follow it. And I love that you mentioned the gut ones. There's things like the GI map. We can look at calprotectin. We can look at some of the stuff. Interestingly, there are some people I see who do GI maps and other gut tests who don't have elevated calprotectin, but clearly have stuff going on in their gut.
Totally.
So,
I see that a lot.
One of the things that I've struggled with, and maybe I'd be curious to get your take on this, is we don't really have a great test for leaky gut. I think like so many of these things, there's a clear indication if somebody has gut issues, they probably have leaky gut, but it doesn't seem like we have a great test for leaky gut. You know, stool zonulin seems inaccurate, serum zonulin kind of nonspecific. There's lactulose mannitol, not that good. Maybe PEG 400. What do you think about this? I mean, I think that it would be valuable to show people, hey, you have leaky gut and I don't have a great test for it that I'm aware of.
Yeah, you're definitely hit the nail on the head. There are definitely cases where you know clinically they're going to have some intestinal permeability. They have wild out of control inflammation. We can measure that on blood tests. They have obvious GI symptoms as well. And then the labs come back completely fine as far as looking at intestinal integrity or permeability. That is true. There's no perfect test for that. The best test that I have, and I'm sure, I mean, you have as well, are the looking at the mucosal lining of the gut, kind of understanding that intestinal barrier, that first line of defense, as far as that's concerned. And then comparing that, or in addition to running lipopolysaccharide antibodies and occludin and zonulin antibodies. So you kind of look at those and look at those different snapshots. And those labs are probably taken on different days. So that's kind of a good thing too, to kind of catch the immune system on a different day. And you know, I think those are the best we have at this point in science, but what we're talking about is really just the cutting edge of how these things are impacting the body. But it is a learning tool for many people. It helps them to see on a lab, this is what's going on here. But the cool thing about what we do is that you don't want to be overly myopic on one thing. And I say, well, yes, it looks like you have intestinal permeability. It's not showing here you have going on. But what we do know is you have all these other things going on. So I'm never hanging my hat on one thing anyway. So they can have a leaky gut syndrome or can't have it. Like maybe they have it, maybe they don't. We don't always see that on a lab, but we do see there's never a lack of things to deal with, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Yeah. So we can kind of focus on the things they can see measurably on a lab to then lean into.
It's like a constellation. The picture starts to come together.
Exactly.
Definitely does. So in the book, one of the other things you mentioned that I really like is that there's no neutral food. Tell me about this, because I agree with you. I think, you know, we may have slightly different opinions on what might be good or bad, but I like this concept. So tell me what you mean by that.
Yeah. So, I mean, and I don't, when I wrote the inflammation spectrum and how I live my life and how that I practice functional medicine, I don't have an agenda, an overt agenda about making broad sweeping statements, overgeneralized statements. I really wanted the reader of the inflammation spectrum to find out what works for their body and what doesn't. So if they want to be carnivore, like how do you do carnivore the best way? Or if they want to eat mostly carnivore, what does that look like for them? If they want to eat a paleo or a ketogenic or a mostly plant-based diet, what does that look like? What's the best food under that food paradigm for them to focus on? So what I was saying with that statement is that every food feeds inflammation or fights it. It's serving one camp or the other, some in major ways and some in small ways. And obviously there's ones that are serving one camp or the other in such negligible ways that you're not going to be able to notice it in your life or even measure it on a lab, but it's doing something to your biochemistry. It's instructing your biochemistry in one way or the other. Is it net positive or is it a negative? And that's really the bigger message that I wanted to bring into the book, that people think, well, it's just this and it's just that. It's not that big of a deal. But to really bring the gravity to this whole topic around food, that every food we eat, every meal we eat is influencing our biochemistry. It's instructing biochemistry. It's instructing our microbiome. It's impacting inflammatory cascades in a way that people are not just they're not conscious of. So that's really why I made that statement.
I like it. I like it. I think it's either helping us or hurting us.
Yeah.
And we try to become as astute listeners to which signal we're getting from food. And I think that's what we're both trying to do. So what are some of the common, I think we're going to agree on this completely. What are some of the most common food triggers that you've seen? And what are some of the first foods you pull out when people are having symptoms?
Yeah. So the top, what I call the core four in the inflammation spectrum would be grains, added sugar, dairy, and high omega-6 oils like canola oil, vegetable oil, That's what be what I would call a core four foods too. If you're not eating clean, if you're just eating whatever, look at those four foods first. That's what I've seen clinically and what research points to being major drivers of inflammation for the human race.
Yeah, I like it. And I mean, I totally agree with the grains. I think that you have another one, which is called, there's eight foods. So if you expand that, what is the full eight that you pull out beyond that?
Yeah, so then the eliminate track. And why I put two different tracks is because based on the quiz score, people that score lower on the quiz, they may just want to start with the core four and kind of focus on that. And we talk about the food and the non-food components to inflammation, because the book is more, we're talking more than just about food, because we talk about stress and toxins and sleep and social isolation and screen time, all these other things that can impact inflammation too.
So yeah, I want to
make that clear. But eliminate is the core four plus four more. And that includes the nightshades, that's like tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, goji berries, white potatoes, then nuts and seeds, legumes, and eggs. And I love most of those foods on the eight. I don't have an axe to grind on any one of those foods, but I want the reader to find out their own bioindividuality, because I do great with tomato sauce. I love ketchup on my grass-fed burger. I don't have a problem with it, but I know some people can get flare-ups from that. So I want people to really find out what works for their body and what doesn't.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. And one of the things that I think readers maybe, or listeners may be surprised about, is that there's a lot of nightshades that we're not aware of. People may know that nightshades are tomatoes, bell peppers, all the spicy peppers, eggplant, things like this, but goji berries are a nightshade.
Yeah.
What nightshades am I leaving out here? White potatoes, what else?
All the spices, a lot of things that are in like different healthy packages.
Paprika, cayenne. Yeah. They're all nightshades, and they can all be triggering. And I think that, you know, I just released a podcast with Stan Efferding, and we talked about these vegetable seed oils. Hopefully most of the listeners of this podcast are familiar with how damaging these can be. But I love that you included that in the core four, because I think these are a big deal. Oxidized vegetable oils are horrible. I just want to share one other study that one of my friends sent me this week that I thought was really cool. I don't know if you've seen this one. I can send it to you. So the title of the study is "The Type of Dietary Fat Modulates Intestinal Tight Junction Integrity, Gut Permeability, and Hepatic Toll-like Receptor Expression in a Mouse Model of Alcoholic Liver Disease." That's a mouthful, but basically this is a mouse model of leaky gut. And what they found is they actually compared saturated fat to a corn oil unsaturated fat and looked at leaky gut. And the saturated fat did not induce leaky gut, but the unsaturated fat did. So I thought this would kind of like be a kind of a recapitulation of what we were talking about with saturated fat in the past. Yeah. There are definitely some interventional studies, at least in this animal model, that show that saturated fat is not in and of itself bad, but unsaturated fat that's oxidized, like an oxidized corn oil, in this study, increased intestinal tight junction protein mRNA expression compared to saturated fat, which just means that if these are the occludin proteins between the junctions, between the cells, if that mRNA gets upregulated, the body's making a lot of that because they're pulling apart. So I thought that was a really interesting study, because it's saying, hey, corn oil is horrible. Hopefully at this point, listeners, will know that like processed vegetable oils, super, super bad. Do not believe the canola oil hype.
Yeah, you're a listener, so you're preaching to the choir, but they're family members, on the other hand, and they're friends, other things. So people still need to hear this message for sure.
Yeah. And so there are vegetable oils that are going to be, that are not going to do that, but a highly oxidized processed vegetable oil is going to be a big, big problem. So that's so interesting. Okay, cool. So here's the question that I've been waiting the whole time to ask you. Do you use a carnivore diet in your practice? Do you feel like there's utility for this? How many of your patients are on a carnivore diet, my friend?
I love it. So you would think, as the author of Ketotarian, like, what the heck? This guy's like going to hate the carnivore diet. And maybe you heard me talk in other podcasts, because people ask me this all the time. But the truth is, I use the carnivore diet in my clinic all the time. So again, my agenda is, how do I get that patient, that human soul that I care for, how do I get their life improving? How do I get their lab improving? And there's some people where I need to do what I consider to be the ultimate elimination diet, which is a clean, well-formulated, nutrient-dense carnivore diet. And that's how we use it in the clinic. They're reacting to a lot of things. They're having like the core four and the eliminate, they're having reactions to all those in pretty significant, severe ways. And they're reacting to all the plant fibers like salads are throwing them in a turmoil. They're reacting to whole foods, like healthy foods, plant foods, anything, where we have to lean into what I would consider a sort of an amalgamation between a GAPS protocol, gut and physiology or gut and psychology syndrome, broth, soup, stews, but a completely carnivore approach with organ meats and fish to really give people the appropriate nutrition they need, but also downregulate the inflammation and allow the gut to start to repair and not stop overreacting to all of these foods. And then we transition them so their body does not create more reactivities longer term, meaning that they don't become, their microbiome shifted in a way where they're not able to digest any plant fiber longer term. So I find it to be an amazing tool to use in the short term. And what do I mean by short term? It could be months for some people. It could be quite a long. So this isn't like a 3-week carnivore experiment. This is months for many people. But then to start with lower FODMAP, cooked stews and soups, pureed vegetables, easy to digest in bone broth soups and stews, and then lean them into eating a whole foods, nutrient-dense diet with plant foods in there as well. So that it's a tool that I use. It's an amazing tool for many of our patients. So I think that just like we've been talking throughout this whole conversation, context matters, and you don't really, it's easy to have a tribalism when it comes to food or anything in life when you are just like writing articles or talking about it. But when you actually see patients for a living, you have an open mind and realizing even healthy things, what works for one person may not work for the next person. Even things that may not be applicable for you can really benefit other people. So that's my heart on the matter.
I think it's awesome. I'm so stoked. I'm going to send you some copies of my book for your office. I definitely, all of my clients do not eat exclusively carnivore diets. I definitely have people on carnivore-ish diets. Let's dig into this a little bit before we wrap up. Do you have concerns about the microbiome without plant fiber? Because it's something I've been thinking about a lot recently and looked into a lot. A lot of people will often say, oh, you need plant fiber to have a diverse microbiome. And I like to kind of offer the other side of research, but I'd be curious your take on this. You kind of mentioned, hey, we like to get plants back in, but I'm curious what your concerns are and why you're bringing them back in, and maybe we can offer some different sides of this equation for people.
Yeah, I think that I don't want to be hyperbolic about it, because I think that for many people, if they're eating, again, a well-formulated, the way that you advocate the carnivore diet, if they are doing that and they're getting way more good things than bad things, meaning that they're in a better state, that it's better for them to not to do any reintroduction of vegetables at that point. Maybe they just need more time, or maybe this is a tool that they're using to manage their health and their symptoms. And that's wonderful. But for some people, they do want to have more variety. They do enjoy vegetables. They want to have that part of their life. And we want to find a way to lean into it. And it's not enough, in my opinion, when someone's doing a carnivore diet or any type of elimination diet for any period of time, to then bring in a food you hadn't had in a while overnight. And then if your body, if you get bloated and you get symptoms from it, and then you think that you're having a reaction to that food, well, is it a reaction to the food, or is the microbiome hasn't digested that food in weeks or months? And you have to lean back into it to kind of have some communication with your microbiome to say, we need to start making the proper microbes and the enzymes to start breaking down these foods again. So that's what I would recommend. And that's why we lean people back into these foods, starting off with the cooked pureed foods in soups and stews, lower FODMAP, easier to digest, basically these sugars and fibers, and then moving from there. So the concern that I have for some people is that if you're avoiding plant foods for long periods of time, that it's going to create a reactivities to foods they otherwise normally wouldn't have. Meaning if they didn't have a problem with this plant food, but then when they do reintroduction after a longstanding carnivore diet, they have an overt reaction. Well, again, is that a food sensitivity or is that a microbiome problem that you just need to kind of allow that microbiome to repopulate appropriately or recalibrate appropriately? That's not an irreversible thing. You can get that the proper infrastructure as far as microbiome and enzymatic function to be able to digest that. It's going to take some time. But a lot of times people are overwhelmed with what that means. And when they bring it back in, they just feel like they've created more of a restrictive diet. And I think for some people, and this can apply not just to the carnivore diet, but to the ketogenic diet and vegan diet for sure, is this sense of orthorexia, where it's stress and anxiety about whole foods, about real foods. And that can play a mind game as far as stress and anxiety for people around this, which if more people were eating just whole foods and real foods, and even if, you know, it's way better. And I don't want people to become overly fearful about vegetables. And I think that's definitely a nuanced conversation that you have to have for somebody that is going to benefit from a carnivore diet for a period of time.
Yeah. I think that's true. I don't think that I've always tried throughout my sort of research and discussions of a carnivore diet or animal-based diet to not be dogmatic and to avoid that type of orthorexia. I think that there definitely are people who can do just fine with some plant foods. Mm-hmm. And the reintroduction, when people get a reaction, is quite interesting, because a lot of times when people eliminate plant foods, they will also get, you know, sort of GI symptoms as the gut microbiota shifts. Yeah. So I think that as we bring it back, we can get changes in the gut microbiota. But it's striking for me as a clinician to hear that some people will reintroduce food sometimes and they get like these systemic, almost what sound like inflammatory symptoms. They get like depression, and you're thinking, wow, that's striking. You know, you reintroduced potato or sweet potato and you felt depressed. Like, we don't really know what's going on there. And I think that that's definitely something that we're still trying to understand. Is it your body reacting to the food or adjusting to the food, or is that food actually just triggering the autoimmune reaction? Yeah. But, I think one of the...
Well, I think if it persists, I think that you have to kind of lean to that. Yeah, that it is contributing to the problem. Because normally, if it's a transition thing, it's going to pass. You know, it's not going to persist.
Yeah. And I think that one of the cool things for me about a carnivore diet is that within functional medicine, a lot of the teaching is that plant foods are just amazing, you know? And I like to kind of just bring the competing idea that for some people, plant foods can be triggering. And, you know, we talked about that, whether it's dairy or grains or legumes or nuts, or I think for some people, broccoli can even be triggering, you know, that's just, so I people are always like, eat the rainbow in functional medicine. And I think, well, I'm just not convinced that plant foods are all benign, but I appreciate the kind of measured approach there.
And the core four and eliminate, I mean, all those foods I mentioned are all plant foods. So definitely, there's no denying the science around it. It's no denying the different proteins that can be reactive for certain people. Well, I guess other than dairy and eggs, but dairy and eggs, most of them are plant foods.
Yeah. But I've definitely seen people have reactions to dairy, as we talked about earlier in the podcast, and also to eggs. I'm still trying to discover or, you know, really understand how much of it's yolk versus white. I definitely agree with you that it's mostly the albumin and egg white.
Yeah.
That yolk is less reactive, but I think some people can have reactions to eggs. And as I've heard you talk about in another podcast, a lot of eggs are fed, a lot of chickens that make the eggs are fed junky things, which maybe some of that protein, the corn or the soy, is getting into the egg. You know?
I've seen that where people have like the pasture raised eggs. They don't have a reaction to it, but then they have the vegetarian fed eggs and they have a problem with it.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. When I'm eating eggs, I try and get pasture raised, corn and soy free. I mean, really, I should just be getting like wild duck eggs, but I don't always have access. So if people are listening and they have issues with eggs, that could be one of the nuances there. So that's awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. So I love it. The carnivore diet making an appearance in ketotarian headquarters.
We should do the carnivore plus ketotarian like love fest tour around the country.
That's amazing. Let's do it, dude. Well, the inflammology tour for sure.
That's right.
So I got one more question for you, because I've been getting a lot of questions about this and I want to hear what your perspective on it is. And this is not really related to the diet stuff, but you know, I don't know if like there's been I think that Peter Diadamo recently republished a version of his blood type diet stuff. And a lot of people have been asking me, what do you think about blood type and diet? And I'll offer my opinion, but I'm just curious, you know, what do you think about this? Because it's a relevant question. A lot of my listeners are asking it, and maybe we can both just weigh in on it.
Yeah, I get asked that question a lot, and I have gotten that question for years. I've looked into it because people ask me that, and I have to look into it. It's part of my job, but I haven't read the book in its entirety, to be fully frank. But I haven't seen any research really at all around that. I see anecdotal, it resonate with readers. I see it resonate with patients that are coming in as consults that are like, no, like this, I see this true in my life. So at that point, I'm not going to supersede what they're seeing in their life. They got benefits from it. But I don't have anything to back it up to say, well, this is why it is. And nor do I see that with everybody else with that type of blood type as well. So is it correlative? Has he found some things in his clinical experience that he could find that? But obviously, I think that he's coming from a decent place and I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt. But I don't necessarily think the benefits are coming from the blood type changes per se as much as he's putting everybody on a whole foods diet and he's cleaning up the diet and going off of a lot of processed foods. So I think overwhelmingly, that's where the benefits are coming from, not from the tweaks of being this being more plant-based and this one's being more paleo-like or whatever. But what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, throughout all, I mean, I think I first heard about this like 15 years ago or something when I was a ski bum and long before my medical career. And at that point, I'm B positive, I think, or B negative. I forget whether it's my Rh factor is, but you know, he advocates for a lot of lentils for people that are, you know, blood type B. And I know that every time I eat lentils, I get GERD, and I never get GERD. I never get reflux. But when I eat lentils, I get reflux and it triggers my eczema. So I think my personal experience, even before I went into medicine, was that doesn't seem to work for me. And then when I dug into the science, I was like, yeah, most of the studies are done in with like red blood cells in like culture or in test tubes, looking at agglutination assays with food lectins. And it doesn't really seem to have any physiologic basis or correlate in the human body. So I feel similarly. If somebody's eating that way and they're feeling better, then great. But I'm not convinced about the scientific backing. The question I get a lot of times is, I'm a blood type O. Is that why carnivore is working for me? Or I'm a blood type B. Will a carnivore diet work for me? And I can emphatically say that as a B blood type, the carnivore diet works pretty well for me. And I don't think we should be limited by these things, nor do I think that there's robust science behind it. So I'm glad that we could both weigh in on that. So that's awesome. Cool. Sure. So the last question that I always ask my guests, I should have warned you about this one, but I'm sure you'll have a good answer. So what is the most radical thing that you have done recently? This is like 80s radical.
Oh, I was saying radical like cool or radical like crazy, this guy needs help?
Radical like cool.
Okay. Oh man, radical. Let me think. You know what? This is radical as far as 80s radical cool. I never get to like go on vacation with just my family, like just my kids and my wife. It's normally like a work trip and like one of my kids comes with me. I have two kids, 13 and 10. And I got to speak at in the Grand Cayman at this health summit. But afterwards, I got to stay a couple of days with my family. It's just probably not so radical for everybody else, but for me, it was super radical because I got to just chill on the beach in Grand Cayman and go on a bodyboard with my 13-year-old son and go like underwater to get these conch shells. And like, I learned how to like get that snail type creature inside that shell out. And the locals taught me how to do it. It was super fun because it was conch season. So it was completely legal. And I loved that. So that those simple moments where you just like have nothing but like the beach or nature and your the people you love, to me, it was like the best. I love
That's it. Amazing. That's pretty radical, dude. Did you eat the conch?
No, I didn't. I gave it to one of the guys that helped me. It was too gross. It had sand all over it. It was disgusting. But the guy was excited. He was like, I have dinner for tonight. And I made his day. So
that's awesome. That's awesome. I mean, I love being in the ocean. I thought of one more question that I'll ask you and then we'll wrap up, because I know that you have a podcast with Goop, right? You're on the Goop Fellows podcast.
Yeah.
And this is interesting for me because that's a primarily female audience. And one of the things that I thought would be uniquely interesting for you to comment on was, from my perspective, the narrative for a lot of women has been that red meat or meat in general is not good or is fattening. Do you kind of sense that? Like, I just feel like a lot of women, whether they're eating carnivore or paleo or they're doing plant-based with some red meat, so many women need red meat in their diet and they've just been, do you observe that? Is there really kind of this negative narrative around red meat for women? And how can we combat that if you think that it's a valuable thing for them to incorporate in their diet?
Yeah, I do. I it's definitely higher than in the men or what men wellness community. I think it's probably because it's probably a cultural thing first, where it's like eating red meat just seen as more masculine. And I think that's probably part of it. And women just tend to shy away from it and have less of that in their life, generally speaking. Obviously, there are many exceptions to that. But that trickles down into the marketing. It trickles down into what's being sold to them and the different products that are out there. And that plant-based world in all its different powders and protein powders and food products and things like that are marketed to women. And then that becomes sort of the mantra of the day when it comes to the health blogosphere for women. And so it again, it's this reductionist view and oversimplified view, but to the layperson that's not in health and wellness, then they equate and demonize that and think that it's something negative. Or they, when I look at application forms and they are almost bragging on it that they aren't, they're putting it as one of their things that they avoid. So look, you pat them on the shoulder, Dr. Cole, because they're avoiding it. And it, they're completely upside down as far as their perspective on what they should be focusing on. So that is, definitely something that I see, and hopefully we're changing that conversation. Most of our listeners on Goop Fellas are actually women still, even though it's coming from a guy's perspective, and more guys, more than ever, are interested in health and wellness, which is awesome, which is why Goop Fellas came to be. We still talk to predominantly women. It's so interesting how the universe works. Like, we were just talking about you, Seamus Mullen, my co-host, and I. We were like, we want Paul on the show. Like, if he's going to be on. I didn't even tell you this. And literally, I didn't know I had you on the schedule today to do the podcast. And I'm like, what the heck? I just was talking to Seamus about you earlier in the day. I'd have you on the show so you can educate the Goop people about the carnivore diet.
The Goop people. I love it. I'd love to come on, man. I would love to come on and talk to women or talk to a predominantly female audience about red meat and how we don't need to fear it and how it can be a healthy part of a big diet. And it doesn't have to be carnivore, but gosh, I mean, so many good nutrients there. So I look forward to that. That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah,
man, it's been so good talking to you. Where can people find more of your stuff? We mentioned your books, Ketotarian, The Inflammation Spectrum. They're both amazing. I encourage people to check them out. Where can people find more of your work?
So everything's at drwillcole.com. That's drwillcole.com. And yeah, they can get all the information there. I appreciate you for having me on.
Yeah, man. Thanks for coming on. I encourage people to check that stuff out. And I so appreciate your measured approach. And I look forward to hanging out with you soon in person.
Yes.
All right, you guys, thank you for listening to that episode with Will Cole. Thanks to Will for coming on. Hopefully I will be having a conversation with Will soon on the Goop Fellas podcast, and we can share the message of the carnivore diet with some of the men and women who listen to that audience connected with Gwyneth Paltrow's stuff. But I really enjoyed this conversation with Will. Like I said, he is quite an eloquent guy. I really like the way that he thinks about things. We don't think about things completely in the same way, but Will definitely includes a lot of good animal products in his diet. And I love having discourse with people sharing different sides of it. I hope it's helpful for you guys to hear all of it. So as I said in the beginning of this podcast, the book is coming out. It's coming with a vengeance, and I can't wait for it to make a big splash in February of next year. The all who pre-order will be invited later this week to a private Q&A with me. So if you submitted your pre-order, you should be receiving an email from me later this week telling you the date with a special invite for a private Q&A with me. If you want to pre-order the book and support me that way, you can go to thecarnivorecodebook.com. You can also go to my website, CarnivoreMD, go to the Carnivore Code link there on the website. You can also sign up for my newsletter, which is something I try and put out every week to share what is going on with me, podcast stuff, an article, and other fun happenings and insider information. If you are a subscriber to the newsletter this week, you will know that I now have a new t-shirt and it says Stay Radical, which has been a fun thing to develop. And I hope you guys will all enjoy it and wear it with pride. It is linked on my website. It is also linked on my Instagram, or you can go to Design Tree, which is the people who are making the t-shirt or helping me make the t-shirt. It's dsgntree.com. And I believe it is going to be linked under CarnivoreMD or Stay Radical, which is the slogan on the shirt. So check out my t-shirt. I'm going to be talking about that more soon. The book, all these other great things. Hope you guys are having an awesome holiday. I am hanging out in San Diego for the holiday. I'm going to be surfing and working on more projects to connect you all with great resources and exciting things for next year. Many cool things are in the works. White Oak Chela is coming, you guys. It's coming back. Super successful. It's going to be May of 2020. So get ready for the event of the year at White Oak Pastures. So please check out whiteoakpastures.com. check out the landing page there, which will soon be White Oak Carnivore MD, I believe. And right now it is info.whiteoakpastures.com/carnivoremd. Ancestral Supplements is ancestralsupplements.com. Love and appreciate you all. Happy holidays to you all. If you're celebrating Christmas, Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Merry Kwanzaa. I don't even know all of them. Anything that happens at the end of this year as we're celebrating, I love this time of year because everybody comes together and gets to value their families. So I hope you guys are all doing that. And I look forward to talking with you in the new year. Actually, there'll be one more podcast this year, and then we'll do the new year. So keep killing it all, you guys. Keep staying radical. Keep letting me know what's good, what's bad, how to get better. I love and appreciate you all. Take care.